While Roy is faffing about with his bag, I'll just welcome you all to the first reading of the spring term Warwick at Writers at Warwick series. And this evening we begin, as we should, with the finest of the arts, poetry. And we have two distinguished practitioners to my left, Roy Fisher, to my right, Ian Duig. You might expect principles of age and all of these things, honour and whatever, that Roy was going to come second. He's put his foot down and said he's going to go first. So that's what he'll do. And Ian will then follow up. And after their readings, there will be an opportunity to ask some questions. I shan't give you long introductions, but I'll just say briefly for those of you who've been elsewhere for the last 50 years, that Roy Fisher is certainly one of our most distinguished poets. He's been publishing since the mid-50s, and fairly early on in his career wrote what many, I think, by now have been very happy to recognize as one of the tremendous masterpieces of post-war English poetry. Almost every word in that needs qualifying, or rather it needs a comment. English, yes, it's very English. He's from Birmingham, and the city which formed the model for the sequence city is recognisably Birmingham, although he doesn't make a meal of it. It's not full of local patriotism. In fact, his agenda is a quite different one, but I don't know if he's reading anything from it tonight. It's conceivable. For those of you who don't know the sequence, which is in poetry as well as in prose as well as poetry, you'll find that it's by now found its way into the mainstream canonical anthologies such as Paul Keegan's new Penguin Book of English Verse. And so it should. I'm delighted it has done. It's possible that Roy has grown tired over the years of being told that an early work was a masterpiece. Throughout his writing life, he has been extraordinarily versatile in tracing the, should we say, the sounds, the patterns that words make when they're under pressure. I think that's a fair way of putting it. He's a jazz pianist. Jazz has been a great love in his life. And I think you find that affinity all the way through his writing. And you find also a very deep recognition of the values of demotic traditions in American poetry, and also of all kinds of nonconformist poetry, I suppose is the best way of putting it, in this country. I would claim myself that another masterpiece, in some ways bearing a resemblance to City, followed it at a long distance, and that is the long sequence of Furnace. It's not been, I believe, as widely recognized as a triumphant achievement as City has. But it bears a very curiously similar imprint of this understanding that there is almost a will in the cities that we fabricate for ourselves to live in that becomes independent of us. It's almost as if the thing, the city, the collective, were its own living being. This is something which maybe we can come back to in questions. There's an extraordinary quality there which I don't believe I've ever begun to get to the bottom of. It's fascinating. I'm very much looking forward to this evening's reading by Roy Fisher. But before we come to Roy, let me say a word or two briefly about Ian Duig. You can probably tell in this, yes, the lighting has changed. It was a bit disco-ish a moment ago. But you can probably tell that Ian is not yet quite as senior as Roy.
Gotcha now.
He's got his teeth in, we can tell. Ian Duig, at the moment, is very much in the minds of many because he's had some conspicuous success recently. I mean, the title poem of his latest collection, The Lammas Hireling, won the National Poetry Competition and also the Forward Poem of the Year prize, a striking double whammy. It's his fourth collection, isn't it? And I think from the very word go, he struck everyone as having a very different and personal and idiosyncratic voice. I mean, the humour is wonderful. There's endless, bizarre, ironic invention going on in the poems, much of it coming straight out of fact, a lot of it evidently not invented. I mean, he's got a tremendous relish for the absurdity and grotesquerie of life and history and beliefs and so on. And in touching on beliefs, I'd like to make a point about beliefs, because well-held beliefs and wrongly held beliefs are, I think, of equal interest to him and fascinate him, and are the mainspring of a lot of his concerns. And I think that when you scratch away a lot of that zest and humor, you come to someone who is deeply serious and deeply moral. And when I say deeply moral, I don't mean he's going to get on and bore us with a sermon this evening, but I think there's a tremendous seriousness in this very funny man, and I think that's a great pleasure when one encounters the real thing. I've talked for quite long enough. I'm going to hand over then first to Roy Fisher and ask you please to welcome him to Warwick in the usual way.
Not you or me. We shall find out. I must thank Michael for that warm and full introduction, which had saved me the trouble of doing it myself, but I shall do it just the same. Always been fascinated in heroic poetry at the way in which the heroes would be very un-English. Beowulf, for instance, gets off the boat to approach Hrothgar's court, and he says, "Beowulf is my name. I have performed many deeds of valour in the past." I thought, how would I do in these circumstances? And this is the tiny poem called Epic. "Stranger, in the land you come from, how do men call you? I will tell you. Men call me Roy Fisher. Women call me Remote." That was a short bit. Everything else is going to be rather long, because I want to read you a sequence. This is... Well, I don't write poems with the aim of explaining them, but this is a sequence which hasn't been published complete, and it will have a couple of little geographical footnotes, which I will give you. There's no need to take them from dictation. It's to do with the place I live now, which is in a way different from Birmingham. It's just inside the Peak District National Park. And wherever I go, I find industry. I live on a lane which was cut through a medieval strip field in order to bring coal down from a set of little coal pits, a whole coal field on the moor above, which is now a grouse moor. And this interplay between, you know, town and country, nature and so forth, is always with me. I live among Bronze Age tombs and quarries. And the place where I have, this is a sequence called the Dowlow Drop, which incompletely gave its title to a collection I did. And Dowlow is a hill which rears up behind my house, and there the Peak Park, with all the implications of a national park for beauty, heritage, rural ways and so forth, stopped dead, because this hill goes up to the ridge where there used to be a line of Bronze Age tombs, and then falls away into a huge quarry. So there is nothing for the national park to be a national park about. It's just a great void. And my poem, which is a sequence with a central theme which isn't stated, if the various bits point to it in, from different angles. My poem is about the way in which half the population cultivate the land where I am, the other half dig it away and make toothpaste and margarine and all sorts of things out of the very fine quality limestone. The central theme is a not unfamiliar one, and it's to do with the way in which I suppose the idea of technology being male and nature being female, the good old good one, has sort of permeated the language and the concepts of transcendental things being above and somewhat intense things, dark things being below. And I play around with this. And I found myself thinking, what was it like in this land before Christianity, when the earth was what concerned people very much, as it still does? They either dig it or make money out of it. What was it like when consciousness was different? And here we go. The Dalo drop. When the far bank darkens and the river starts to die, the nondescript silently fights for its life. Next. So out of what materials shall we be making our nothing? There had been nothing made, no yet about it, no suggestion something was bound to come about. That nothing could then have pictures done of it, and very light. True nothing needs hands to build its many forms. There had been made that which was nothing. So now, out of what materials? Something harvested, woven, bleached, or harvested, pulped, bleached and pressed, or chosen for pallor in the ground, quarried and sawn into straight sheets, polished, breathed even as a cloud from some temperature maneuver, all edged with particular tastes. Is the mother back from the mine? White-eyed out of the footrail, having all afternoon given shape to certain debris, certain chunks, having been final on matters that offered themselves in darkness under the birch scrub slope. Made from whatever material, the blank skin announces no show. Empty time. When it puckers and punctures, its slit straight mouth behaves as a reverse letter slot. Almost everything that tumbles out is furniture and the like, lived with but not digested, sideboard, ironing tackle, things for the kitchen that match, air freshers, seersucker sheets, candlewick covers, mugs that match, all the covers of crisp bread, oldish damp towels, heaters, the mail, the sweat and push to sustain all that through a winter that won't end. And a short interval, and the next section deals with the time I embraced the great goddess of love. Strange though that may seem, I think I was half paralyzed a couple of years after this act of sacrilege. If you go to Paphos on Cyprus, you are shown the bay where Aphrodite appeared on a pink chair in the Botticelli painting and so forth, and there's a little museum, you may have seen, where the goddess is the thing that was worshipped, and she is in fact a cone of black volcanic substance about this big, which had fallen from the sky and been carried as a totem, and which was worshipped in a shrine there for many years. And there she is. And I walked into this museum, and very comfortable looking object. So, as you do, I gave her a little cuddle, which probably counted as harassment. Because the people were with me, it says, do not touch the idol. There's a notice, I ignored this. But there we go. Aphrodite from the sky, fallen in Asia, black, ferried to the island, a sacred lumpish cone, smaller than women, raises the dead, and walks them for a while without explaining. My schoolmate Deep, 47 years hanged, parks the same rented car as mine, directly beside it, lopes into the courtyard, makes for the cool museum hall, where she sits, the landlady, hiked out of shrine rubble and dusted down. He's aged just as he had to. Same chicken leg gait in shorts, same haircut, grey, grown the only moustache he could have, gained a small wife, and he might just be now, by now, German or Danish. He's quieter, a good career in the science behind him, following a narrow squeak in youth. I could greet him, dull idea, if I didn't believe my knowledge. Died at 15 in his delight, alone in the house, clothesline over the banister, mother's underwear. Fine calculation, could have been finer. Too much buzz. The senses of the day comforted the boys with suicide, impatience, despair, tragedy. Said nothing about the underwear. Hanging yourselves, man's work. Go along and over the last level ridge of the Staffordshire mudstone above Longner, and the limestone starts up at you from the Dove, a ragged barricade of tall, crooked points and green humps. The turnpike dives, kinks to cross the river by Lost Soham. Vasta est. Far enough north to be harried. The manors along the Dove wasted, then after King William's days of deep speech listed. Beyond the river, the road heads up through the barrier, on the bed of the vanished feeder stream that tapped and emptied the shallow sea's last lagoon. On the rocks at the grassy lake floor's edge, I'm living in a house built as a publican's retreat. And across the lake, the waste called Dowler Moor rises high and quick to the first true edge of the limestone upland, the line that joins Hindlow, Briarlow, Downlow, Hordlow. Illusion, the set tilted with its bushes, walls and crossing cows, and cutting off at the sky, where the national park stopped dead also, fresh out of scenery. There's no backside to Dowlow, a straight cut, quarried down hundreds of feet to the floor below base level, the immense abyss of jobs. From the rim, a view over all the fields to the east, green with their own dug line, seethed in their mother's milk, cratered at Tunstead, Dove Holes, Topley Pike, with more prints of New Eleusis. In the next one, the dead speak. On a day I could hardly be present, a group I guessed at came to the ridge here again and opened the mound, laying there three rivets, a grooved bronze dagger, flakes and a knife of flint, a piece of iron ore and a bone pin. With these things and others, they placed my own dead body that I had to be food for the journey all rivets and the like must make. Under the floor I could feel the deep spindle of rock within the ridge of rock, narrowly holding us up forever. The whole ridge went, the pillar went as I went, the rivets saved. Take out the commissioner's roads, the lead rakes, poison copses, cattle mears, water tables sunk out through mine drains, pick off the farmsteads and the long cowshit slips on the tarmac. All these drawn things, fade the inks, depopulate the sky of everybody with the headless light legs that stalk under the cloud. Shift it around, put it all back naturally. Cosmogony, that the mother vanished from the planet's hide and its surrounding vapors hung with lights that decorate and instruct. Went down in the earth, brought out of herself the seemingly straight line, the right angle, the working in metals, the grenade, the brick, for all to consider, and the rest of it, each year a fresh hall she provides, herself in every part imminent, her light in all of it, a world of town halls with no fathers. That voice you heard in the womb all that while, over your head and down through the ducting, no matter what it happened to be saying, stays with you till you die, no matter what you say with it. Not only in desert cliffs, rock faces of a front, cities of single rooms piled along ravines, but from afternoon shadows and the crevices of seats by night, there's a wonderful growl to be heard. That's the end of that one. And I'll read you a bit about art. This is called A Modern Story, and I wrote this, I suppose, over 20 years ago. It was at the time when the large poetry competitions were just starting, and I always like to read this. Well, there are always people who are going to win prizes, and you never know who they are. And I was obsessed with the idea of where the money comes from and where it goes. All I can say about this is that the first three words were true at the time. Being past 50, with suspiciously few enemies, and just about enough achievements, I was sat in my garden watching over my grey peas when there came to me, not in a flash but more like a sunken boiler, slowly and implacably surfacing of its own volition, the finest of all my ideas. It felt even then as though it might be one of the five best projects for a literary work in England at that moment. And you know I was right. The Arts Council Literature Panel awarded it one of their five bursaries, £7,500 I got. But when the check came, it gave me writer's block. 4 days. 5, 6. After a week, I no longer knew myself. In what I can only call now a fit of distraction, I founded a poetry competition with my bursary money as the prize. Though mad, I was canny mind. I first sold my eldest son my project, cash down, to pay for the ads. Then everything suddenly got very fast. 32,000 entries came in at £1.50 a time. That's 48 grand of a handling problem. To help with the mail and the critical rough sorting, I was able to take on 4 unemployed PhDs and 3 newly redundant publishers' editors under the government's work experience scheme, and to give my youngest son a youth opportunity. Sorry. And when it came to hiring the judges, I asked a few friends I valued for their fairness and cynicism to guess who they'd inevitably be. It warmed my heart to be able to prove them right. Then, 3 weeks before closing date, I saw how I could use my small business starter allowance to double the prize money. And that announcement brought in a late crop of entries, 6,000 or more. There were no problems, such as the judges giving one another the prizes. They gave them to next year's judges, as it turned out, but nobody knew that at the time. So, with part of my 50 grand profits and the unstoppable weapon of 38,000 stamped addressed envelopes targeted on poets, I quickly put in a bid for a chain of South Coast vanity presses that had overreached themselves and needed the gas bill paying. At which point, an easy-voiced man telephoned and asked to see me about England. I thought he was the Inland Revenue and invited him round with caution. He was tall, very affable, a little cold. Anthony Bate could have played him. His conversation was light, oblique, and wide-ranging. He gave the impression of a man in some way authorized, yet there was something in his drift that was erotic, though in no way he could specify. At length, I was seized by the idea that while taking care, not in so many words to say it, he was proposing to sell off to me, very cheap, for me and my friends to do whatever we wanted with, a piece of England. The Arts Council Literature Department, the staff, the files, the goodwill. He leaned back and looked into my eyes. The figures took me only a second. No deal, I told him. I'm a straight businessman now, not a gangster. He gave me his card. I presented him with one of my books, edition of 2000, remainder. My old publisher would never publish that poem. Amazing how much of it has come true. I'll read a tiny bit from City. And I'll read you, I think, a bit of prose. As Michael said, this is venerable. I think I wrote the things that make up this collage in the late 50s, and it was first assembled in 1961. So, if I can blow the brown spots off the paper, just a little conjuration. A street half a mile long, with no buildings, only a continuous embankment of sickly grass along one side, with railway signals on it, and strings of trucks through whose black spoked wheels you could see the sky, and for the whole length of the other, a curving wall of bluish brick, caked with soot and 30 feet high. In it, a few wicket gates painted ochre, and finger mark but never open. Cobbles in the roadway. 100 years ago, this was almost the edge of town. The goods yards, the gas works, and the coal stores were established on tips and hillocks in the sparse fields that lay among the houses. Between this place and the centre, a mile or two up the hill, lay a continuous huddle of low streets and courts, filling the marshy valley of the meagre river that now flows under brick and tarmac. And this was as far as the railway came at first. A great station was built, towering and stony. The sky above it was southerly. The stately approach, the long curves of wall still remain, but the place is a goods depot, with most of its doors barred, and pots of geraniums at those windows that aren't shuttered. You come upon it suddenly, in its open prospect out of tangled streets of small factories. It draws light to itself, especially at sunset, standing still and smooth-faced, looking westwards at the hill. I'm not able to imagine the activity that must once have been there. I can see no ghosts of men and women, only the gigantic stone ghost. They're too frightened of it to pull it down. And there it still is, Curzon Street Station, which has now become heritage. And I rather think there are luxury flats inside it. But that's history for you. One more thing, and it's again about art. It will be... Oh, yeah. spent some time wandering through Greek museums and was fascinated to see figurines, vase decorations en masse, all describing a quite small range of mythic subjects. And these myths were very solid and could be returned to over and over again for images and associations, and had obviously been strongly functional as well as decorative. And thinking through, as one does, idly, through the Renaissance, which used Christian myths very strongly and very constantly, a quite small range of things, so that exotic things like Judith and Holofernes and Jael and Sisera and driving nails through men's heads were quite marginal. And the obvious conclusion was that we were without a mythos which we can refer to over and over again in this way. Impressionist painting would paint all over the place but would not return to central mythic themes, and it's gone on from there. And I thought idly, what have we got? And I moved from the museum to a little bit of thinking, and then back to museums as they might be. It's called On the Neglect of Figure Composition. Prelude. Hundreds upon hundreds of years of lapiths versus censors, Sabine women abducted by ferocious male models in nothing but helmets and little cloaks, the corners curled on their privates, such fading mileage out of archaic views, it all passed. But I propose a fresh batter of Britain, the parties to be as follows. First, all those who come to believe our profoundest guidance to be the person and style of His Late Majesty King Zog of Albania. Yes, Zog of the white yachting uniform, of the pistol for shooting assassins, of the plump princesses in matching rig and sharing his peculiar gift of being able to make himself appear rancid when photographed. All British Zoggists mimic his dress and demeanour, his small upturned moustache, the proud suspicion of his eyes. In times of truce, they hold conventions at weekends in the hotels of our former manufacturing towns. They dress up, eye one another, make wild plans. Most repugnant to them are the Ionists. Once no more than a small quasi-theological dream, but lately more numerous and moving in the land, though not, it must be remembered, given much to travelling, for an Ionist is far more likely to project, or simply telephone, his outlook and will for implementation to another in the desired locality. They are a sort of conceptual cavalry. The heart of Ionism lies in a constant meditation upon the real Ion. The real Ion is neither sportsman nor entertainer, but a part-time polytechnic lecturer called Trevor Hennessy. He teaches of two polytechnics, one in the Midlands, the other in the home counties, and he is not explicit. Ionists are the most implicit of all known people. Sketch for the first exhibition of the new heroic art. These just go like a set of lantern slides. Ionists and Zoggists resting between engagements in rocky terrain. Next, the spirit of Queen Geraldine, born on a cloud, encourages flagging Zoggists during a skirmish near Burnley. Bipti, members of an Ionist cell, brushing their crests, appraising one another's crests. Next, a Zoggist cohort of the first rigor, surprised by Ionist irregulars. Next, five Ionists scorning to interrogate a captured Zoggist. Next, the Zoggist college under snow. Next, Ionists driving randomly coloured Ford escorts in formation on the A1 near Peterborough on a fine April morning. Next, the Zoggist, Velasquez did this first time, the Zoggist acceptance of the surrender of Weybridge. Next, suburban panorama incorporating Zoggists enacting enforced exile in reduced circumstances and Ionists enacting unacknowledged supremacy. Next, a particularly thick page, a modest Zoggist borne unwillingly in triumph on his comrade's shoulders. Next one for your Christmas card. Zoggists in their cups. Next, condemned Ionists already blindfolded exchange comments on the turnout of the Zoggist firing party. Next, Zoggists hiding in an Ionist's laundry. Next, Ionists relaxing with their women. They sit silent in a circle drinking white rum, while their women dance quietly to records in the other half of the room. Next, the first time in his whites, The mother of a Zogis cadet proudly puts the finishing touches to his uniform. Next, an Ionist foraging party mingling with the crowds in Sainsbury's. Next, Oxford Zogists in Baha'i. And finally, the passage of the real Ian through Purley by night. And I won't even apologise to Ian for taking his name in vain, because as everyone can see, he is not an Ianist, I think. Right, that's me. Thank you.
How's this? Can you hear me? Excellent. As we explained at the beginning, we're reading in reverse worth order. So I'm really the person who should have opened the reading. And what I intended to do was use a phrase of Roy's, which describes my approach to the area that's important in this book. Earlier in his career, Roy, talking about the importance of place, said, Birmingham is what I think with. And a lot of these poems were written during my tenure of the Northern Arts Literary Fellowship. And I became so saturated with the region and what was going on with it that really the North is what I think with in this book. However, where I start is a little bit earlier in my career. My interest in my personal appearance sort of peaked about 35 years ago. If Mike Quinn is in the audience tonight, he might remember some of these fashions. It was really when the first wave of skinhead fashion entered its Rococo period. It's called Blood. We used to go very quickly. You couldn't wear boots anywhere because obviously, you know, they looked dangerous. So what you used to do was buy these particular shoes from the Squire shop, which had a very wide apron sole. Then you immediately got more soles put on it, metal bits at the front and segs at the back, which sort of clicked and sparked as you walked. And the effect you were trying to get was, as someone described it, it was like being kicked with an axe. This is called Blood. Tiptoe to flex your brand new squash shop Oxblood Oxfords, their Chippendale varnish palimpsest of spit and polish, finished with one occult pass from the black shoe brush to Rembrandt to veneer, even now reflecting veal pale calves, white all on ankle socks beneath petrol blue Levi's stay pressed, their baked creases rising to the occasion of red braces, clip-ons, a half inch in width over brick red and duck egg, Brunswick triple stripe, button-down collared Ben Sherman, Rizzler packet and packet of three-shaped bulges in its pocket, then up to plenty more 14-year-old slunk vellum neck, bum fluff, stench of brutes, cotton chips, light and bitter, pilot-style gold-framed honey-tint lens Polaroids, crop fuzz from number two skin to a she revisionist suede head, inclined to the painted window of Luke's tattoo parlour, affecting a genuine temptation to turn over a new leaf of your as-yet still virginal unilluminated manuscript for a Yakuza bodysuit, Blood Eagle, Bull's Head, Serpent, Web, Dragon, Axe, Scrolled Heart, Skull, Drum or Trumpet, knowing them to be erasable only by Goldfinger's laser beam, though last Wednesday, outside the school nurse's office, in front of the whole queue of third years, you blacked out just at the glimpse of her lance of a vaccination needle. I never did have the courage to get a tattoo. My father was Irish, he had a tattoo with mother written on it, and he said that was the only one you could get in Ireland until the 60s. This is the title poem of my book, The Lammas Hireling. There's lots and lots of stories about hares all over the place. A few points I will make, though, is I was struck by a phrase from someone in Northern Ireland talking about hares as the cow with leather horns, and of course they mean the ears were like horns. But if you look in Seamus Heaney's translation of a Middle English poem called The Names of the Hare, he translates it as the cow with suede horns. And it seems to me extraordinary that expression has been going on for so many hundreds of years. There are variations between the idea of people changing into hares and werewolves and things like that. You know, for example, in the Hollywood movies, Lon Chaney is always Lon Chaney at the end of the film. In these stories, very often people change back into animals when they die, which is, that's what happens here. And you don't necessarily shoot them with a silver bullet. Very often you melt down a coin which has a cross on it. I hope this is clear. To go into the hair gets you muckle sorrow, muckle care, variations on a very old theme. You'll find one version of it in the Allensford Pursuit, which is Robert Graves' reconstruction of a 17th century North Country witch's chant, the Lammas Hireling. After the fair, I'd still a light heart and a heavy purse he struck so cheap, and cattle doted on him. In his time, mine only dropped heifers, fat as cream. Yields doubled. I grew fond of company that knew when to shut up. Then one night, disturbed from dreams of my dear late wife, I hunted down her torn voice to his pale form. Stock still in the light from the dark lantern, stark naked but for the fox trap biting his ankle, I knew him a warlock, a cow with leather horns. To go into the hair gets you muckle sorrow, the wisdom runs, muckle care. I levelled and blew the small hour through his heart. The moon came out. By its yellow witness, I saw him fur over like a stone mossing. His lovely head thinned, his top lip gathered, his eyes rose like bread. I carried him in a sack that grew lighter at every step and dropped him from a bridge. There was no splash. Now my herd's elf shot. I don't dream, but spend my nights casting ball from half crowns and my days here. Bless me, Father, I have sinned. It has been an hour since my last confession. This is, there's a very good Scottish poet called Burnside, John Burnside, and I read something where he was talking about that uniforms can be difficult on places at the edge of empire, like the British flag and so on and so forth. And this is indeed true, but there's a friend of mine who lives in York, a Malawian poet, Jack Mpanji, and I was looking at these photographs and him and his friends when they're back in Malawi, and they're all wearing string vests. And I thought, how extraordinary. Me and my family, we all wore string vests. I remember sitting down to breakfast with everyone, and I was thinking, this is it, you know. I have discovered the mystic livery of international slobdom, you know. It is the uniform we can all wear, string vests. So this poem is called A Dream of Wearing String Vests Forever. For everything that lives is holy. For a string vest does more than only connect, embodying kinship networks. It is my ancestral tartan, the breakfasting doohig, light as an aura massage or love's gappy language. An ontological conundrum, nothingness patched being. What is the length of a piece? To what lengths would it go? Only so far. It can't flatter. But a must in emigrant kit, though born in Antarctica, it is at home in Africa, and if a gaff at the opera, it's a good sign in hosts of ease with their guests. It grows like the universe, constantly, in every direction, a dream catcher, however stretched, holding its integrity and warmth. Dad's gift, to get the hang of it. My sisters were born and brought up in Ireland in the 50s in a rural part, Munster. And very often in other writers, this is represented as a time of terrible privation, and indeed it was. But they had their own experiences of luxury. This poem refers to one of them. The Lark in the Clear Air, it's called, is the name of a tune which appears in the song. All dewy-eyed, my sister told me how she once got up before the dawn to see her birthday rising on the Glen of Aholo. She skipped up frosty fields like bleaching sheets, but heading back, she paused to catch her breath and saw her footprints spread out everywhere like ginger biscuits on a tablecloth. She gently hummed the Lark in the Clear Air, judged her run-up to some cooling cow shit, guessed when its crust would be mass wafer thin, then took off, flew, and landed slap bang in it to feel the quick give of that eggshell skin, then bwinye surging hot between her toes. Tomorrow she shall, as her old song goes. Making money. This one came between Dial a Prayer, He had a dialer prayer system going. And then he also became a wheel clamper, a ferocious wheel clamper. This was really because he wanted to dress his girlfriend up in a black uniform, but nevertheless, he was getting people into all sorts of trouble. And they had him on, if you saw this on TV, you'll know who this is about. It might only have been local TV. When he was up in court for some particularly blatant, piratical piece of clamping, the TV people interviewed him outside and they said, "Why do you do this?" And he said, "I want to be the most hated man since the Sheriff of Nottingham." This time he had the idea that knives, there's a lot of trouble about guns in many places in Leeds, people are shooting each other more than they used to. But he discovered if you have an antique knife, if it's more than 100 years old, you can't be done for possessing it as an offensive weapon. You know, it is an antique. So this was his, this is what he thought would be able to do with this. It's called Cutler's Poetry, which is a phrase meaning, they used to put these little sort of jingles up the blood groove on knives, and it means bad poetry. Cutler's Poetry. "I was a Soho nightclub doorman, which doesn't make me Martin Bormann. You don't stop fights by tuneful humming, and most I brittled had it coming. But then one night I learned a lesson, by courtesy of Smith and Wesson. I'd stroke this bloke across his hooter, when bless my soul, he pulls a shooter. Both it and him went off half-cock, and I cabbaged him, but I'd had a shock. Soon half our punters packed the gun. The dance floor grew more like Verdun. Chucked someone out for too much boozy, comes back blazing with a newsy. I'd recently become a father and get an earache from the carver. I changed careers to quell her qualms and started selling antique arms. With short-term rentals on the side, for real solutions, nothing schneid. You'll stabilise your twitching bottle with a sundae or a shuttle. Though if a sanded down Chivona lends some panache to your Chivona, a connoisseur of cold steel stabs his victims with a honed pesh cabs, parang, panjar, or basilard, a falchion, a kyber card. Or if he's aiming at your back, he might select a fine bag knack, an estoc, Saxon miner's axe, an aikichu, a scrammer's axe, a shashka, or a ski and do a lady's size, and damn good too. So show your metal at the disco, this blade's inlaid by Francisco. The chasing on his bronze Ricasso calls to mind the late Picasso. It's Gottfried Pappenheimer hilt will help you through survivor guilt. So cut a dash, don't look barassic, slash with an established classic. See, even law subscribes to fashion, the press might stir the public's passion, and if the filth are told to step on possessing an offensive weapon, with my stock you have no fears, all older than 100 years and each a certified antique. The filth can't do a thing but deek, while if you're found with any gun, you're done and dusted, my old son. The doors revolve, you go in rich, but come out as some winking's bitch. If you don't like it up the arse, then shop with me and show your class." This is, I was doing a session up in the northeast with a school where the terminology is very complicated. The kids had emotional and behavioural and learning difficulties. So I wanted to do something which they might enjoy. So I did boasting and cursing. That's what we did. People, we did workshops around both of those activities, and I had to produce my own. I did a couple of curses, in fact, and this one was in Bath. They discovered, when they were sort of investigating, they discovered all of these little, this little kind of system of magic, which unusually was only for men. Very often they might be mixed and some things may be reserved for women. But this particular one seems to be entirely conducted by men. And what you do to curse a person is you scratch your curse backwards in a piece of lead, roll it up, drive a nail through it, and then drop it in the sacred spring. So this starts from a curse that I really did find there. And the curse was, "Ki mihi will be am in walawit sik likat komoda aqua." And what that means is, "May he who carried off Vilbia," Vilbia being a woman's name, "may he who carried off Vilbia from me become as liquid as water." So this is called Vilbia, after the woman. "He got to where he'd say he's come to love me, when suddenly, mid-lie, he stalled above me. Thinning like air, great heat was making shiver. He held a second, a bridge of glass. Realized the horror coming to pass, then pissed himself from ice to raging river. Breaking on me in some undoing birth that pulled him back inside his mother earth." I put on a clean robe. I spoke a prayer. Then I washed that man right out of my hair. One of the areas that I was responsible for was the very heart of the foot and mouth outbreak, the Penrith Spur, which is where Wordsworth's house and the Wordsworth Museum is. And I read there, and someone asked me to write about this, and I'd been avoiding it, to be perfectly honest. I was brought up in a city, and I'd not been close to any major rural issue at all. But the people I was staying with, the woman was from a farming family, and she knew a lot of people. And I suppose the thing that brought it to mind is she used to watch the CFAX, where it listed the local farms, which were going down, which were off limits, and things like this. And I have as many doubts as I'm sure people here have about the politics of food, but the horror of the lonely suicides that were taking place when I was up there, I found difficult to ignore. This is called There Is No Rose of Such Virtue, which is the title of an old Marian hymn. Perhaps I should explain that Beltane, the old May feast, cattle would be driven between bonfires for fertility. And this was happening at the same time. It was in May that I was going through the countryside. And it was a nightmare version of Beltane, really. There is no rose of such virtue. Our Lady of Atheists, broken from hope, I pray to you, somehow that helped me cope. Mad shot in the dark, much like my verse, but all that white night bad didn't turn worse. I ask for a young man with rings round his eyes, no stock to take care of, his struggles to rise, till night yields to night, with hardly a seam. Asleep or awake, it replays like a dream. The needles of truth in the haystacks of crap, the watching cold death, excuse me, the watching slow death creep over the map. The tact and compassion the bureaucrat wields, the speedwell and silence that strangle his fields. His wife held his talk, it goes round and round. All flesh is brass, they sold out the pound. When all's said and done was what's spun. She waters his whiskey, she's buried his gun. The sun or the moon is over Great Mel. Some Canada geese are scouting the fell. It's Beltane, so increase is honoured with fire. The trumpet of smoke slowly lifts itself higher. Last star in the darkness shot silk of the kine. There's other Madonnas, but you were all mine. Our Lady of Atheists, I know you're not there. That doesn't matter. Answer my prayer. There was another opening, which is somewhere not far from here, in fact. It was a kind of remembrance, particularly for the person. The person who was the statue is the person that this poem is about, a bloke called Herbert Burton, who joined the army very young in the First World War, and what happened to him. And in the statue, he's tied to a stake for reasons that will become obvious in this poem. The stake. Penny a poppy. Its petals, she said, would cover the stains on Herbert's chest. She bought two poppies. Their little black eyes, she said, were opened by Herbert's trial. She bought three poppies, for she said their stems were green as that squad of trembling men. She bought four poppies. Their pins were of steel, she said, that was softer than what she feels. She bought five poppies and rattled a tin. So for her shilling, I remember him. Private Herbert Burden, Northumberland Fusiliers, born 1899, volunteered 1914, shot at dawn, 20th of July, 1917. I was asked to write this poem. A lot of the poems in the book, I must admit, were commissions, and they didn't have that much in common. So I was trying to sort of give some sense of unity, and this is where Roy's remark about thinking with Birmingham really got into me, that I knew I needed to get inside things if I was going to make any sense in this at all. Strangely, this came out of left field. It was a woman who was opening a fiddle school in Kerry, which is a very area of great fiddle players, traditional music we're talking about here. This is after a bloke called Padraig O'Keefe. If anyone knows Irish music, if you know O'Keefe's slides, that's Padraig O'Keefe. And one of the things he used to do was use as a variable mute a key which he held between his teeth when he was playing, and he used it on a lullaby. So, the fiddle teacher. When Padraig played one lullaby, the big old door key in his teeth, he'd stroke it on his fiddle's bridge to raise a teething baby's cry. She puts new keys between their teeth and cuts them on the grape and gun. She breaks the silence as they clutch to wake the fiddlers underneath. Some time ago, there was a thing in the paper about somebody was talking about the fact that the pure Anglo-Saxon culture of England was under threat with all of these refugees and people seeking asylum. This must be that pure Anglo-Saxon, Danish, Jute, Frisian, Norse, Swedish, Romano-Celtic, Irish, Scots. It was already that mixture at the time that this Anglo-Saxon poem was written. This is related to a poem in the Exeter manuscript called The Fortunes of Men, but this is much reduced. It's just called Fortunes. Watching children play, we know they're bought with grace from night to show them what we hope is love and the world's turning light. Soon we're paying out their growth in clothes and shoes and caps, but what's in store for them in turn? That girl who's Tig, perhaps. See her a woman wiping her footprints from the dewfall's silver memory. She bears a child in injuries, wife to Jew, gypsy, refugee. This child here will betray his Lord and be crucified on the crossroads tree. Hear him cry then, his wits astray, his playmates burn out his family. That one drowns, those grow rich. She, with 12's endeavour, see her shin up an apple tree. She must fall, she falls forever. More than Cain's clan bear a mark, that laughing boy, grief will break him. The night is strong, our roads dark, Christ the way, take him. I'm going to finish with two poems about things which happened when I was terribly upset. I got to know a poet called Andrew Waterhouse. A couple of years ago, he won the Forward Best Prize for a first collection called In, and he was a genuinely talented poet, a genuinely nice person. I got to know him through a workshop where, you know, sometimes it's like weasels in a sack, you know, the ego is out of control, but he was persistent and kind. He was also an impressive musician and a committed ecologist, buying land and reforesting it. And during the time I was there, he killed himself, which had a huge impact locally. This is called Rosary. It was written for him. I should explain that where I was staying in Beadnell, you're not far from the Farne Islands, and the boats that mainly go out, Billy Shields used to be a fisherman, but now he runs a lot of boats out there. They're all called Glad Tidings. He was asked once on telly, I can't remember who it was who asked it, but they said, why do you call all your boats Glad Tidings? Is it a superstition? He says, no, I just can't think of any other name. Rosary in memoriam. All Billy Shields' boats are called Glad Tidings. The last will ferry me across to Andrew Waterhouse, where he is writing now, with an upside-down coble for his home and office on his own unnoticed farm. There turns eggs, litter stones that are also eggs, under the Millennium Party of the Northern Lights. They'll show me the way to find Andrew, waiting for me. He'll tell me again what he told me in the Bridge Hotel, how the individual pages of the Lindisfarne Gospels, if left too near a fire, shrink from it and start to reassume the shapes of the calves they parted from. And I know if I ask, he'll tell me all their names. And the last poem, I'm very sorry that David Morley is not here, he's ill, because it was an approach from him that led me to write this. He was putting together an anthology called The Gift for the NHS, and this was written about a woman in Durham. I was in Durham when this happened. She had worked with the NHS. She had an autistic child, She'd had to give up work because of the strains. My wife is a psychotherapist in childhood adolescent mental health, and she works a lot with families with autistic children, and it is a terrible situation for mothers in her circumstances. She left work, her husband left her. In the end, she was led to the act which this poem describes. The first two lines of the poem are from Chikamatsu, as they call him, the Japanese Shakespeare, from a play called The Sonozaki Love Suicide. He was noted, apparently, within the tradition for making these plays take place at specific locations, real locations, as in Sonozaki was, and also for the introduction of a section called the Mishiyuki, which is the flight section, and the first two lines are the first two lines of his Mishiyuki flight section. This is called the Viaduct Love Suicide. Farewell the world, farewell to the night, farewell my family, forgive me this flight. I did my husband's, though with him was gone, the last of the good times for me and our son. When I needed bread, life gave me stones, that fairy tale giant made bread from my bones. Had our communion, a stone for a host, my son, you were special, different from most, and most take against the difference as strange. With names, if not stones, they take their revenge. Returning to where that no stone can touch, you made my life, son. I love you so much. She stepped from the bridge, her child in her arms, to join with the earth no providence harms. Wind from the wheat fields blows through Bridge Hill. The last light of evening falls on Black Hill. It falls still on concert, on lead gate and delves. This song is over. Look after yourselves. And thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Roy and the real Ian. I've got a couple of questions I'd like to ask. I think that's you. Yeah. And we'll throw it open in a moment. Roy Fisher, I remember reading at length in 1980 when his first collected poems was published by the publisher we don't mention anymore. 1955 to 80, it was. And I hadn't read much of his work at all before, just a couple of odd things. And I remember going through this book and being stunned, and it became rather a revelation to me. I gave it that sort of review, very enthusiastic. I remember he wrote to me after that. It's very rarely that someone writes to you and thanks you for a good review. And this was at the beginning of my life as a reviewer, and I had no idea whether it was common or rare or anything. But
well, I have to say that you used one word which I treasure.
Oh.
Which was hilarious.
I did. There were some very funny poems in the book, and I loved them, but I thought there were other things as well. But the thing that struck me about Roy's letter, apart from its absolute pleasantness and modesty and whatever, was what seemed a completely unfeigned surprise that anybody would actually take the time to read the whole book. And that stuck with me. And I wanted to ask you about that aspect of it, if you don't mind, because it seems to me that it took a while, quite a while, for the establishment or the metropolis, perhaps London or whoever it is, that brokers' reputation. So it took an awful long time for them to wake up, really, to Roy Fisher's work. And I have a sense that for probably the first half of your writing life at least, you must have sensed that you were somewhere out on the fringes waiting for somebody to actually notice that you were there and were writing this bloody good work. Is that how you felt, and do you feel that it's effectively changed now? Or how do you feel about the pattern of your writing life is what I'm asking.
Good God.
Especially in a poetry environment that is so much governed by a sense that particular locations, especially in London, publishing houses and so on, are the brokers of taste. We have to face this as a fact, don't we?
Well, I have to say with all arrogance or whatever that I ignore it as much as it ignores me. I mean, I've been doing this for 40-odd years, and it occurred to me that today that I don't write constantly. I have a few patches of a couple of years when something works in my mind, and others when nothing does, and I do the rest of life. And for ages, I spent my time playing the piano in jazz clubs or teaching. And when I lost the power of one hand, I was thrown back on literature, so I think a bit more about it now. I've never actually dug the world of reputations and so forth. I tend to read... I can speak in sentences, or I could. I suppose I get ideas, I always have got ideas, more from films and music, visual art, and oddly enough, my poetic guidance has nearly always been from way, way back. I mean, almost the only poet I've been a contemporary with who I would go to for more than the cut of his jib or catching the way he worked or the way he came on, to like it and appreciate it, as I've done for many poets, would be Basil Bunting, who could lay it down and let you know what you ought to be doing and what you were a bit of a fool if you were wasting your time with. He behaved like a master and was a master, and I knew him well. But apart from that, I get my clues very promiscuously and have consequently never swum in literary ponds very much. Many of my best friends are poets, but I don't know their work nearly as well as I know them, which is a strange thing.
I'd like to ask you another question before I move on to Ian, and I'm sure the audience will have other questions of their own to ask in a moment. This I'm aware, may seem a slightly odd question, but I believe it's part of the same complex of your personality, your poetic personality, if you like, as the modesty, which is a quality of reverence that I find I come across quite often in your writing. And I think that the Dow Low Drop horrible, yeah. man. I think that exemplifies it very well. There's a sense that the almost tactile exploration of the land will, as it were, give it a presence through language, which is, as it were, almost is tantamount to its real presence. And that act of almost reverence before the given, it seems to me it's as close as someone of your temperament gets to an act of worship, if I can put it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is this going too far, or do you identify what I'm saying about this?
It's almost
spiritual, isn't it?
Yeah, if I want to do that, if I want to write the world, and I can write things better than I can write people, to be honest, I get close to a simple article of faith, which, if I were, as I sometimes am, helping or hindering people with their writing, which is observation. What are your senses telling you, and how does the result of what your senses tell you, this is frightfully empirical, what does that haul from your senses? How does it sing? It may make a music in your language. How does it sing? I'm not a dualist, but I have to say, where is the soul in it? And for me, and my philosophy gets about as far as Lucretius and about as far as Epicurus, and that seems to me to have got it right, so there I stop. And that's that's the bag I'm in, which is the world. And I can't psychologize, and I can't analyze, and I can't issue slogans. So I'm limited to that. I'm quite happy with that. And consequently, I will stay there and go into what I can find out about economics and history and what people do. I can't write characters, so I don't.
I'll come to Ian about that. It's often seemed to me that an inspired Birmingham City Council would bring together Roy Fisher and another Brummy, Raymond Mason, the artist who's in his 80s now, lived in Paris most of his life, and asked them to produce some thing, as it were, visually and in words together.
He sees very much as I do.
I would think he would, yes. I would love to see that done. So petition Birmingham City Council to do that. But I'll go over to Ian now. It strikes me, Ian, in this book, and it was very vividly apparent in the reading this evening, that you share a lot of ground with the Australian poet Les Murray.
I'm a huge admirer of him, yeah.
I'm not thinking only of a dream of wearing string vests, which echoes one of his titles, but there are two strands. On the one hand, very clearly, the Catholic strand, and with that, an understanding that that the glory of God can be grasped through words. There's also a strand which is the magpie side of Les Murray's character, as it were, which is busy gathering curious facts, peculiar stories, and relishing them and telling them again and filling in lots of extraordinary words and becoming a sort of encyclopedia of the world, as it were. I mean, this is, as it were, the Lucretius that you see as well as an interesting... Do you recognise yourself in this description? Do you feel that?
Well, I mean, I think I probably have... I do think there are many things about life which are wonderful. And I write a lot about things which aren't. But I do. There are so many things that I am interested in. There are so many things that turn up. I read Gates' biography, Roy Foster's biography of Yeats, I would recommend to anyone. But things which stick in my mind is the young W.B. Yeats sat on a sofa at Kathleen Tynan, the poet Kathleen Tynan's house, who I think is much underestimated as a poet. She wrote a fantastic poem called The Cattle, which is in Michael Longley's new anthology. So Yeats is sat there and he eats this whole tube of opium-based pastilles and goes to sleep for 36 hours, you know. I mean, I think things like that are just fantastic. It's not related to anything at all, but I will always remember things like that, you know. I will always remember things that really, you know, when you're doing things seriously in a scholarly way, you don't really have time to hang around and look at these oddments and things like this, but I'm not a scholar and I have the leisure of being able to do that. And there was a constant sort of, one of the things about the North, which I will not be able to write about, but I thought it was a wonderful idea. They have these things in Newcastle called piercing parties. And the idea is that, big fashion for body piercing and tattoos, as you can imagine. And if you're having a party, the person who might be do body piercing says to you, I'll come to your party and I will do any piercing or tattoo that you want if you can let me set up shop there. So you do that, of course, you can have whatever you want. But needless to mention, when people get drunk at a party, they want all sorts of things, you know. The things that you will agree to when you're drunk at a party to do to your body, you wouldn't ever have anything, you know. There's a great bit in Herodotus where he talks about the, in his histories, you know, when he talks about the Persians taking a decision that they had to think that something was a good idea when they were sober as well as when they were drunk before they did it, you know. I thought the idea that you need to build in that sort of a rule into society was interesting, but I certainly think you should build in that rule into a piercing party, you know. Before you wake up the next day with your Prince Albert or your... The thing they were doing at the time was the big holes in the ears, you know, like the South Sea Islanders. I don't know what those were called, but they were very popular at the time. Now, you could write a marvellous play called The Piercing Party. You know, Pinter could have done something wonderful with it. You know?
When you were talking about tattooing, I was reminded of the adventure of a friend of my brother's when they were sailors in, you know, on the town, and night on the town in Karachi. And they all finished up in a tattooing parlour. And a guy called Sam Parsonage woke up from his binge in the morning and found it had a tattoo right across his body which said, "Love from Mother, Father, and Dad."
Well, this is it. This is wonderful stories, and they do interest me. I think I probably answered your question by wandering off a tangent, because I think that's what I do in my writing as well. But the world is horrific to the same degree that it is fascinating, you know, and I think you need to give room to both.
I can see that asking Ian a question opens up an extraordinary box.
I'm trying to stick to the point.
let me see if I can find anyone who wants to repeat the experiment from out there. I'm having a... Oh dear, come on. Don't be so coy. Here we are. Here's this lady here. I believe everybody heard that, but I'll repeat it for the tape that's being made. Who do the poets write for?
I can only reply by being flippant. About 12 years ago, I fell off a ladder and brained myself and was concussed. I was put into an ambulance, and the ambulance driver had to drive me. They had to take me, you know, 14 miles across the hills in snow. And the poor chap in the back with me, as I came round, was desperate to keep me awake in case I went down again and had brain damage. And... he asked me various questions. He said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a writer." And he said, "Who do you write for?" And I lapsed. That was it. I thought and thought and thought and became unconscious and got brain damage and all sorts of things. Terribly pompous reply. I write for what I'm doing. I write for the work. Remember seeing those famous films of Picasso, you know, Through Glass, which were Le Mystère Picasso, which were done about 40 years ago, in which he would go into the thing and say, "C'est mal, très mal, très mal," and the work would talk back to himself. And I think, for the sort of writer I am, I can only write into the work, of which I have a sort of ghostly concept, you know, a spectral concept. And it feeds back. If I were a different writer, as many people are, thank heaven, for instance, if I was a writer in an acutely national or partisan setting, and I had a view of people who needed talking to, people who had no voice, and I was the voice of those people, as some writers in some parts of the world legitimately have that feeling and that pragmatic need to make that contact and that feedback, I'd have that concept of an audience. But I don't think that's easily available to somebody in the context we're in here. I don't know.
It's difficult. I was organising something in Dublin. I was working in Dublin, and I was getting Peter Didsbury over. And I wanted him to do a short talk. And I was trying to stress to him that, you know, he could do what he liked. And what I said was, if it interests you, it's got a chance of interesting other people. This is exactly how it worked. It was an interesting talk. And I suppose I don't think it's a brilliant idea, but I sort of think if it interests me and I can do justice to what I find interesting about it, then it's got a chance of interesting someone else. Now, I suspect that the people that it's got a chance of interesting are other people like me, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't really have a huge concept of writing for an audience. But within that, I do try and write clearly, although I do want to share what I find interesting and frightening and things like that. But I suspect at the end of the day, it is pretty much for other people who are like me, really. But if I'm enthusiastic about things and interested in things, then maybe I've got a chance of communicating that. Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. But that's about it. It sounds kind of really low grade, but that's the truth of the matter, really.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing there. I suppose most people have things in their book which are jokes or are like jokes, and other things which come from the sort of mess in one's head, which you know all your life long you could not possibly depict to anyone else, just the way things strike you, the way things are, what you think colours are, what you think it's really like to needing a pee, anything, all sorts of situations. And that's complicated, and in a sense you're talking to yourself. If it's a joke, well, you know, you're not all that far from common ground. A joke's a joke, and it will appeal to some people, other people go blank, but you'll frame it as anyone frames a joke. You'll work it over, you will share your sense of the absurd, particularly with what you know to be other people's sense of the absurd. Some people, not everybody. But I think there's quite a sort of a range between the highly subjective and the thing where you know damn well that you want, that you'd get somebody and say, listen to this one.
Yeah.
Or guess what I just saw? It's a hoot.
There was a very, early on when I began to write, Paul Muldoon did a good description of poetry which made sense to me, relating it to jokes.
Yeah.
A poem is like a joke in as much as it invites you into a world which you might think is familiar, but is likely to have some of the rules suspended, although you don't know what rules are suspended and what rules are in operation until you enter the joke or the poem.
Mm.
Something during the course of the poem will occur, and suddenly you're out the joke on the other side and you're out the poem. But when you look back on it, that is always different for you. Because you've read this poem, because you've heard that joke, that experience is always different for you.
Yeah.
And this is what I find with poems as well. It's different, I think, being a poet for a lot of reasons. But one of the simple things is if you like a song, you keep singing it. If you like a poem, you keep reading it, or at least I do, you know, so I have to return to it for those sorts of reasons. I don't know if that makes sense. Does that make any sense at all? But that's how it works for me anyway.
Did that make sense?
I suppose I say that poems have to have punchlines, but you are left feeling differently. A good poem leaves you feeling slightly different. A good short poem that I use when I'm teaching is by Charles Simic, a Serbian poet who lives in America, and it's about melons, and all it is green Buddhas on the fruit stand. We eat their smiles and spit out their teeth. Now, I will always look at melons differently because of that poem. My life and my relationship with melons has been enriched by that. When I looked at melons before, I never thought anything about them. Now I am constantly reminded of a good poem, you know, and that seems to me a very good way of conducting your life. You know, I am on all sides reminded of wonderful poems, and I think myself not completely stupid for having organized things so I can live like that.
Gentleman over here.
I'm interested in asking Roy about the links that you can see in the world between your interest as a writer in poetry and your interest as a performer in that. How that comes about. And, you know, if I could link that with Ian, I'm sure about being on the sentence. When you've heard what Roy has got to say, what can you do?
I've lived a double life. I took to jazz when I was about 13, and although it was too late, struggled to learn to play an instrument. And I took to poetry much later. The immediate cause was that I had a girlfriend, for some reason, which is now lost to me, who played the viola, or although I never saw or heard her do so, never saw the instrument, and she thought the sounds of jazz were gross, crude, and no wonder I didn't carry on with that affair for very long. So I drifted into poetry. I was reading English in the university at that time, and I suppose there's a very strange relationship, which is not going to answer your question, but I found that at a time I was playing the piano in a style, you know, around 1930-1940, and I was old-fashioned. I wasn't playing much bebop, I wasn't playing anything much more advanced than that. At the same time, I was writing poetry in a style which seemed to me, and which was, I was following my nose, but I was still puddling about in early modernism between the period of about 1905 and 1920. I was thought advanced and slightly out of sight, whereas I'd be playing music of 40 or 50 years later in jazz clubs and being thought a bit atavistic, a bit of a revivalist. This all struck me as peculiar, and it was to do with the speed at which things had travelled. I have a feeling that one thing drained another, that when I was writing, I was free to be fairly dispassionate, except in the sort of, you know, not the way Michael mentioned. I'd be working up reverence or working up imaginative commitment, whereas in piano playing, in which I was less competent, I think, I was quite actressy, I was quite showy and quite histrionic and quite a crowd pleaser when I could get round to it. And I rather think that if that element is missing from my poetry, that's where it got drained into. Now I can't particularly play. Whether it'll ever come back and I shall start ranting and raving, I do not know. Watch this space, at your peril.
Well, I mean, I'm very interested in music, and I'm very interested in the relationship between music and poetry. It was interesting listening to Roy Reed from the Download Drop. I read the book, although some of the new stuff I didn't know. But one of the things which is marked is the musicality, the care with which he organises, say, vowel sounds and things like this, which strike me very clearly. My anxiety about the musical side is, I remember working once with these opera singers, and one of the exercises I used to do was seeing what they had for breakfast, but in Italian. It sounds fantastic in Italian, pomodoro, you know. Rubbish can sound good with a beautiful voice. I think it was Voltaire who said, anything too stupid to be said, get sung, you know. And there was a deep truth in that. There was a point at which the music takes you away, and that tension I find absolutely fascinating. I'm slightly frightened of it. I have worked with jazz musicians in the past, and one thing which I find really difficult to cope with in jazz musician is improvisation.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, if I improvise, it's just rubbish. I mean, it's sort of, I sound like I'm drunk when I'm improvising. You know, there's just no real sense to me at all. I have to sort of do it carefully, and it doesn't work for me. But the attraction and the fear of music, I find really useful, you know. I mean, I used to play a bit. I can play the tin whistle. I used to go and the drum and various things. And there's lots of Irish music in Leeds. They're very high standard. The boast in Leeds when I first went up there was that it had more All-Ireland champions than any pub in Ireland. And it did. It had a singer in the Shannos style called Darragh O'Cahyne. Shannos is unaccompanied, rigid in many ways, but an extraordinary singer. And I could be involved in music, but there was something that made me fear, as a poet, what music could do, you know. And that tension I find seductive. I was never as good as Roy was as a pianist, I have to say. I would be in the background of other people making music, you know. And my style was trying not to make mistakes, you know.
Yeah.
But it fascinates me constantly.
If I can go back to trying to answer the original question, there's an enormous difference between any music, and or almost any music, some score of music fits closely into poetry in this way, like Anton von Webern. But music is basically so much longer. Simple matters like the length of time you can extend a vowel sound. And for me, working in words is on a quite different scale, in that, you know, if you manage vowels, the quantity of a vowel is a very limited compass between the length of a note you can sing or play or sustain. As for improvisation, I don't find it has... Oh, double answer to this. I don't find it has any question, any place in the actual wording of things, the actual craft. I think that is a matter for as much care as you can muster. On the other hand, the following of a theme into uncharted ways, unpredicted ways, fields of association which take you through metaphor that you didn't know you were going to write, and things which end, as I like often to end things, in what appear at first, maybe even to me, are in midair. That seems to me essential, that you must, that your path is and should be crooked, or you're bloody boring, and or very self-satisfied. And I work on that basis. But that's a quite different sort of improvisation from the jazz improvisation I'm used to, which is paradoxically slightly limited if you're in the age of working to chord sequences. You may do astonishing things on the chords, or somebody really good may do astonishing things within a chord sequence of 32 bars, or carrying on over it, or even in more free forms. But, lost the end of this, but it's different.
If you work, I've worked with professional singers in particular areas in the past, and you can hear your consonants disappearing before your very ears.
That's right. Yes.
And that's a bit, that's a bit disturbing, really. And of course, that's why it sounds so good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And of course, consonants in poetry have a much more important place than they do in singing, really.
Would that we had them still in English as they used to.
Yeah.
Terrible language for slipperiness, modern English.
Yeah.
So I used to, I remember...